afternoon. We're going to start with a few slides and then we'll move into the meat cutting dip and give you some hands-on a little bit for your afternoon session. So as was mentioned, I work with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. I manage our meat science work that is funded by the Beef Checkoff. So that is funded at research universities across the country to improve the quality and consistency of the beef eating experience. You heard in the last talk how important the eating experience is to the consumer, how important it is to beef demand. So the industry, the Checkoff, and NCBA have a lot of effort behind the eating experience. And one of the other things that they get to do is product education. So a lot of different cutting demonstration and talking about different cuts, and so that's what we're going to do this afternoon together. And so we're going to start, if you'll indulge me, with a little bit of a Beef 101. So I'm sure we have probably some master meat cutters out there. Do I have anybody out there who would come and do this demo for me? Maybe a few. But maybe some of us, you know, learned about the different meat cuts in the carcass a long time ago, or maybe you never really learned about all the cuts in the carcass. And if you've been following the industry to some degree, you'll know that in a lot of ways, the way we fabricate beef carcasses has changed somewhat over time. There are some newer cuts that are available. There's some cuts that we're seeing really increase in popularity. So I want to visit with you about those. You heard a little bit about international markets and how important carcass utilization is to kind of driving the bottom line of carcass value, particularly open up international markets and putting some of our underutilized cuts into those markets. But there's actually a lot of opportunity domestically as well to utilize more of the carcass, to put more the actual muscles in the carcass and turn those into steaks and ropes and cuts that command a higher price and a higher value than putting those in the grinder. So we're going to talk a little bit about that today as well. So let's start with a little bit of Beef 101. We'll start with the primals, the major primals in the beef carcass, and we'll work our way down to the final and fabricated cuts. Can you hear me? Okay. Is that one a little clearer? Yeah. Okay, so we'll start with the different primals in the carcass, and then we'll work our way down to the final fabricated cuts, and then we'll work our way into the demo. So what you see on the screen here are the major primals in the beef carcass. So when you have an animal that you take to the packing plant and go through the slaughter process, convert it into a carcass, and then the first thing that happens is that carcass is split down the middle in half, vertically down the middle, down through the spine. And so we have two sides of beef. So this visual here represents one side of beef. And it's broken down into the four major primals that you see in red there, the chuck, the rib, the loin, and the round. We also have what we call the thin meats, which are in gray there at the bottom. That would include the shank, the brisket, the plate, and the flank. So these are kind of the home base or the source for all the final fabricated cuts that we can get from a beef carcass. So this is what happens first kind of in the disassembly process. We'll have a side of beef, and then they'll start making cuts and progressively make smaller and smaller pieces from that carcass. So they'll make a break, for example, between the chuck and the rib, between the rib and the loin, and between the loin and the round. So the numbers that you see there represent the volume of each of those primals relative to the total carcass weight. So you look at some of those numbers, like 29% in the chuck, 9% in the rib, 16% in the loin, 22% in the round, and 19% in the thin meats there on the bottom. So those are pretty good averages for what we can expect from each of those different sections of primals in the carcass. What you might notice right away is that the cuts in the middle of the carcass, the rib and the loin, those are traditionally known as our highest value primals. Right, those are where we're going to get some of beef's most popular, most tender, most flavorful cuts from. Prime rib, strip steaks, tenderloin or filet mignon, sirloin, T-bone porterhouse. And so we can expect a lot of value from the rib and the loin. That's where, you know, we get a lot of, again, the most popular, the most satisfactory cuts that are most inherent in terms of attributes like tenderness and flavor. But you see the percentages that are there. 9% for the rib and 16% for the loin, those middle meat cuts in the middle of the carcass that represent traditionally our highest value cuts represent the smallest portion of the total carcass. So we really lean a lot on those middle meat cuts to deliver total carcass value. So the industry as a whole really has been on a process for the last couple of decades to add value to the ends of the carcass, particularly the chuck and the round, to really drive up total carcass value. And the reason being those historically would represent lower value or lower price cuts, but they represent so much of the volume of the carcass. So in order to drive total carcass value, we need to drive as much value as we can from each of those different primals of the beef carcass, and the sum of those parts would be a greater carcass value. So we've really been on a process of trying to mine out the different muscles that are in the carcass and really understand more about those. Are there some muscles that are kind of buried within the chuck or the round that really perform similar to a cut from the middle meat that we can increase the value of if we cut the carcass differently? And the good news there is that there are. Particularly in the chuck, there's some real kind of diamonds in the rough. So the chuck represents, you know, such a big portion of weight of the carcass. Traditionally, you know, going back more, maybe 15 years or more, we mostly ground most of the chucks in the U.S. You see some chuck roasts. You've always been able to find chuck roasts, chuck pot roasts at retail, for example. But you wouldn't see a chuck cut on a restaurant menu, for example. You wouldn't see a chuck steak or a chuck roast necessarily on a restaurant menu. And we, as an industry, we ground a lot of chucks for ground beef. Now, we still do that to some degree. We're always looking for sources of raw materials for ground beef because it's so popular, but there's more value in that chuck if we can find muscles that will work as steaks, for example. So steaks, something like a ribeye or a strip steak, will always command a higher value than something like ground beef or even a roast that takes a longer time to prepare and just perception-wise has a little bit lower quality. So a steak, we know, is what consumers today are kind of looking for, is their ideal. There's times when they need ground beef, there's times when they need roast, thankfully, but a lot of times you're out there looking for a steak, and certainly a chef most of the time is in the market for a steak. So a steak being something that can be put on the grill, dry meat cookery, and still result in a good eating experience. So you think of a classic, you know, ribeye or tenderloin or strip steak, they really hold up well on the grill. So the good news is there are some cuts and some muscles in the chuck in particular that do hold up well as steaks and perform really well as steaks. And the best example of that would be a flat iron steak. If you guys all tried or had the flat iron steak, hopefully you can find it kind of in your neighborhood. It's definitely becoming more of a mainstream cut now. But, you know, going back, you know, 15 or so years, you couldn't find that cut anywhere. So that's a cut that the industry has really worked on and developed, not only from a research standpoint to say, hey, that's a tender muscle that we know is in the chuck. Here's how we suggest you fabricate that to make sure it's a tender experience when you grill it and put some marketing effort behind it to make it a more well-known cut. So that's just one example of trying to add value to this total carcass by looking at all the different muscles that are there, thinking about them a little bit differently than we may be used to, thinking about fabrication a little bit differently. It does take more work to create a lot of kind of the newer cuts that you hear about because it takes more fabrication, which requires more labor. You will have more yield loss, so you've got to be able to make that up by increasing the price of any steak that you do sort of mine out of a primal at the chuck. So these are the major carcass primals, and just think about it as the middle meats being the rib and the loin, the end cuts being the chuck and the round. We have the thin meats there and the gray, and really as an industry working together to try to drive that total carcass value domestically, as well as working on cuts that can be exported to drive total carcass value. So from those major primals in the carcass, and they're broken down another step into what are called subprimals. So these are subsections of those major primals. So for the chuck, for example, we have the shoulder clod, the chuck roll, and the chuck or mock tender that are further fabricated from that full chuck. And in a disassembly process where we remove all the bones that are there, the neck bones, rib bones, shoulder, scapula bones that are there in the chuck, remove those bones, and in the process, break that down into smaller pieces that are called subprimals, like the shoulder clod, the chuck roll, and the chuck or mock tender. From the rib, we primarily get the ribeye roll, from the short loin, the tenderloin, strip loin, and something called the hanger steak, which is a pillar of the diaphragm that hangs off the carcass, is typically removed on the slaughter floor in the packing plant. But it's a cut that ironically has become pretty popular, particularly with chefs. So you might hear about that, hanger steak or hanging tender. from the back portion of a loin and we get the sirloin. And there's two major portions there, the top sirloin and the bottom sirloin. I'm going to be cutting the top sirloin for you here in a minute. The round is also complex, similar to the chuck, so there's a few different subprimals there. The sirloin tip are also called the knuckle. The eye round, the top round, and the bottom round. And then in terms of those thin meats, we have the brisket. So you guys are familiar with the whole brisket that comes out of the brisket section of the carcass. It can be broken down into a brisket flat and a brisket point. Also, the skirt steak comes from the plate, and the plate is the source of a lot of lean trimmings for ground beef. So a lot of the plate is boned out and used for ground beef. And then the flank, which is kind of underneath the loin section there, is cut into the flank steak. So let's take one step further and look at how those subprimals break down into finished cuts. So again, it's kind of a disassembly process of getting bigger pieces down into smaller pieces, ultimately into what's served in a restaurant or what you might see in the grocery store that you could go pick up and buy small pieces that you can manage and cook. So those subprimals are further broken down into the finished cuts. So a subprimal might go to straight to a retailer. The packer might, in their own programs, might break that down further into steaks and roasts and sell those into retail. It might go to a further processor or a food service distributor who age product and then cut those subprimals down into steaks and send those into restaurants. Or some restaurants and chefs do break down their own beef. But for the most part, we are seeing that process of breaking down cuts into the finished cuts happening in more and more of a centralized way. So whether it's the packer itself that has a case-ready program, so they do their own fabrication and they sell those cuts pre-packaged and go straight into the grocery store, or whether it's a distributor that takes care of all the cutting for a restaurant, we've seen that really be centralized, so there's less labor that's required, less skill that's required, less risk that's required, maybe at the individual grocery store and the individual restaurant. So that's kind of speaking in mass and more in urban areas. We still do see some fabrication more at your local butcher shop if you have one of those, your locker plant. If you have a kind of a small independent grocery store or restaurant that you go to, they may be doing some more cutting, but in mass for the major retailers, the major restaurant operators, a lot of those are having that cutting process happen for them and take that liability and take that labor out of the equation for them. So these are some of the finished cuts that you can expect for beef from those subprimals. So from the chuck, we'll get, as I mentioned, the flat iron steak. That comes from the shoulder quad. And that's some work that the Chekhov in particular has been working on for several years now to do research on these cuts and also market these cuts so they become more available and more well-known. Right next to the flat iron steak is something called the ranch steak, and that's a newer cut as well that's becoming a little bit more popular. The chuck tender is also called the mock tender, meaning it is not tender. So the reality is that not all the muscles in the beef carcass are candidates for a new steak, a new flat iron, for example. The muscle of the flat iron is the second most tender muscle in the beef carcass. So what's the most tender cut in the beef carcass? Anybody? Anybody? Yellow? The tenderloin, right? So the tenderloin or the filet mignon is the most tender cut in beef carcass. So that muscle is the most tender muscle. But the second most tender muscle is the muscle of the flat iron, which is in the chuck. So it's far away from the tenderloin or the filet mignon. So we didn't know that. We definitely hadn't validated that through science without this work of the Chekhov going back to the early 2000s. And so the flat iron steak and the fact that it's the second most tender steak in the carcass has really helped propel its success. But there's some other pretty good tender muscles in that chuck as well. And then there's some muscles that just aren't as tender because it's really about what that muscle is used for. If the muscle is used extensively for locomotion and moving the animal around, it's going to have more connective tissue and it's inherently going to be less tender. So there's some cuts like a chuck or a mock tender, for example, that need to be roasted. There needs to be moisture added, and they need to be cooked low and slow for a long period of time because the nature of that muscle makes it a little bit less tender. So we can have, and we do have instances where a tough muscle is sitting right next to a really tender muscle. And so we have to make sure that we treat those muscles accordingly. One can be grilled, one needs to be put in the crock pot. right? So, and then a big part of what the industry has worked on as well is consumer education, to make sure people know the difference between a mock tender and a flat iron steak and how to prepare those accordingly. From the rib, we get cuts like the ribeye steak. From the loin, we get the porterhouse and T-bone, strip steak, tenderloin, and that hanger steak I mentioned. Sirloin, we get top sirloin steak. And then there's also the bottom sirloin that I mentioned. And that's where we get cuts like the tri-tip. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the tri-tip, but that's a cut that started out extremely popular on the West Coast. So it's kind of known as California's cut. And it's slowly kind of spreading east. So I know in Denver where I live, we can get the tri-tip in pretty much any grocery store. So look for it next time you're out. It's from the sirloin, the bottom sirloin. And it works really well as a small roast or on the barbecue. So you can kind of do it like you would a brisket, but it's a lot smaller, so it's a lot quicker, and it eats really well. A lot of different cuts come from the round, like the top round steak and bottom round steak, and I mentioned earlier the skirt steak, the flank steak, and the brisket. So before I get into the cutting, I want to talk a little bit about aging, because we do get quite a few questions about aging. So those subprimals of beef, we start with the primals, and we have the subprimals, and then the finished cuts. The subprimals are what are sold as box beef. So you can get a box of tenderloins, a box of ribeyes, a box of strips, and those are eventually going to be cut down into steaks. That's what a box would look like, a box of tenderloins there on the left. And then on the right, that picture is a centralized aging facility. So they are most likely buying in box beef, aging it for a restaurant, and then selling that cut to a restaurant. So they, in the centralized processing facilities, they take care of the aging process. You have to have a lot of space to age beef. You have to have the right cooler, the right temperatures, and that type of thing. So that happens generally at a central facility. But it's absolutely critical to age beef. So beef aging is really just allowing a natural enzymatic process to happen. We hold that beef for a period of time post-mortem to allow tenderness and to some degree flavor to develop as well. And there are two types of aging. The primary way that we age beef is through wet aging, and that is aging inside of a vacuum package bag. So if I go back one slide, you see that tenderloin there in the picture on the left. That's inside of a vacuum package bag. That's how all beef and box beef is packaged. That means there's no oxygen touching the surface of that beef, and it really helps with shelf life and preserves the life of that product and allows it to last longer. So beef is aging while it's in that vacuum package bag. So it's aging while it's in transportation. It's aging while it's sitting in a storage facility like this. As long as that product is not cooked or frozen, it is aging. And so wet aging is aging with that vacuum package bag on the outside, and that is over 95% of how we age beef today is wet aging inside the vacuum package bag. But dry aging is the other thing that you'll hear about, and if you hang your own beef or you send a one animal here or something to a small locker plant, a lot of times they'll do dry aging, which is aging without the benefit of that vacuum package bag. So a lot of dry aging will happen as a hanging carcass. So you might send your animal to slaughter and it might hang in the plant for a couple weeks before they fabricate it. And that would be dry aging. It's really drying out the outer surface of that carcass. But in mass production, particularly for restaurants, we do see a resurgence of dry aging and just kind of the interest in dry aging. And in that case, they're dry aging subprimals, not the whole carcass. So they'll take a box of boxed beef, like this is a ribeye here in the picture, and this is bone-in ribeye in both pictures. The one on the left is inside of a vacuum package bag, so that's going through wet aging. And then the one on the right is dry aging, so there's no vacuum package bag. It's 100% exposed to the environment around it. You have to have a special cooler for this where you really closely control temperature and humidity and airflow, because you can imagine the kind of food safety risks that you have without that vacuum package bag. And so we do know that there are some differences for beef between the muscles and themselves and how they age. There is an aging kind of response for each muscle. It's based on the muscle itself. It's based on quality grade. And so we do have recommendations in the industry that are out there for optimum aging times for every cut. But here's a little bit of a difference between wet aging and dry aging, just in one quick chart. So wet aging, again, is going to happen inside the vacuum package. Dry aging is without the benefit of that package, so it's uncovered. Both of them are going to be under refrigeration at roughly the same temperature, so just above freezing he's freezing temperature. And then with dry aging, we really have to control humidity and airflow as well. And that's mostly for the safety of the product. But what we're doing with the dry age product is drying out the outer surface of that. So about the outer 20% gets totally dried out and kind of turns a really dark color that you can see there in the picture there. So that has to be trimmed off before we can cut steaks from that and cook those steaks. And so you end up with about a 20% yield loss, up to 20% yield loss on a dry aged ribeye, for example. So it's extremely expensive to do, and it's not as efficient, so that's why we do primarily wet age. But we do get a lot of questions on this lately because there is just increased interest in dry aging. It's kind of going back to the way we used to do things before we had box beef and vacuum packaging. So both methods, the tenderness increases for those to the same extent. So if we wet age or dry age for 2 or 3 weeks, the tenderness will be the same. But what differs is the flavor. And the flavor of dry aged product is very unique. It's very intense, really intense, beefy flavor. And if we were doing a blind taste test, some people here would like it and some people wouldn't. It's not primarily what we're used to, and it's really intense flavor, but a lot of people do like it or are trying it or and are kind of interested in it. But dry aging is going to always be more expensive because you have that yield loss associated with trimming the product. The minimum recommended aging time for beef is 14 days. But we do something called the National Beef Tenderness Survey that's funded by the Checkoff and managed at NCBA. Similar to the quality audit that you just heard about, every 5 years we do that. We've done it for 25 years. And average aging times now at retail are close to 21 days, and at food service are about 30 days. So we're getting really good at average aging times with beef, which is really driving some improvements that we've seen long-term in beef tenderness. So that's good news. Okay, so we're going to shift here in a second to the cutting demo, and I just wanted to tell you about some opportunity cuts that we see kind of piquing folks' interest here for beef. I'm going to cut a top sirloin for you here in a second, but these are a few other cuts that we're getting a lot of questions on, so I know that a lot of different restaurant operators and retailers are working with, but that I thought you may not have heard as much about. So we talked about the flat iron. That's, again, the second most tender cut in the beef carcass, and it really, really has become a mainstream cut. You can find it in most grocery stores. It's generally about the fifth most popular cut on restaurant menus every year. So it really has become more of a household name. And then the tri-tip, that's what that tri-tip looks like. It's kind of a triangular-shaped cut. That's in roast form. It can be cut into steaks, but it's pretty good in roast form. Put it on your smoker, put it on your grill, put it in your oven. Really good eating experience from the bottom sirloin. Another cut that's next to the tri-tip in the bottom sirloin is called a sirloin flap, and that's a cut that we're seeing being used as an alternative to fajitas, basically. So typically we'll use skirt steak or mini plate steak for fajitas, but both of those cuts have gone up in price quite a bit recently, so we'll see a lot of folks sub in a sirloin flap. So that's another cut that you might hear about. Really good, really tender, thin meat, needs to be marinated, and it can be grilled. And then another cut is a chuck flap. This is a piece that has historically been exported, but we're seeing a lot of it being used domestically as well. It can be used as a short rib replacement, so it would be a boneless short rib replacement. So that you might hear about that, a chuck flap. It's also sometimes called an edge roast. Okay, so for the cutting demo, I'm going to cut down the top sirloin. So a top sirloin is what you see here on the picture on the left. That's a whole top sirloin that has the top sirloin cap or culotte attached. The one that we have today has the culotte removed, but you can see what that culotte looks like. The top sirloin cap is that triangular piece that's there on the top, and that sits right on top of the top sirloin. And most times now that's peeled off, and that can be left as a small roast, or it can be cut into those top sirloin or culotte steaks that you see there. That's becoming a lot more popular. It's my favorite cut, and extremely flavorful and tender. So if you see a top sirloin cap steak or roast, I would definitely recommend trying that. And then from the center portion of the sirloin, which I'll cut for you in a second, we'll get a roast and fillet. So I'll do that in the demo. And before we switch screens to camera so you can better see the demo, I thought I'd show you. This is the website beefandswhatsfordinner.com. This is the beef industry Checkoff website for the Beef and Swats for Dinner brand. There's a section there on cuts. And if you go to that section, you can find, I think we have over 130 cuts. that are there. So every cut that you can think of, everything that we know about those cuts, you can find cutting videos and cutting guides and pictures and recipe ideas and everything you, I promise you want to know about those cuts is there. But also on the website, we have information related to, we can switch it over now. We have information related to recipes, beef production methods, you know, how to talk to consumers about that. Nutrition and really, you know, one-stop shop for beef. So that's beefiscooksfordinner.com. We just went through a refresh on that website, and so it might look brand new from the last time you visited it, but it's enhanced, and there's a lot of good information there. So I'd encourage you to check that out. Okay, so what I have here that I'm going to cut for you is the main portion of the top sirloin. Again, this comes from the loin section, the loin primal beef carcass. It typically it starts out by having a culotte, a cap muscle that lays right on top, and that is removed often, so that's been removed. And then we're left with quite a bit of fat and connective tissue on the outside. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to trim off all this fat, and there's some heavy gristle and connective tissue on this sirloin. So I'm going to go ahead and cut that off. And the reason that we would do that is to improve the quality or the eating experience of the steaks we're going to get from this cut. So this is heavy connective tissue that connects this muscle to a bone. And we don't want to leave that on because that you'll just be chewing on that forever, right? It won't be a good eating experience. So we're going to take all of that off. And traditionally, a top sirloin could be cut by just cutting straight across. You know, when you cut top sirloin steaks, and you'll still see these quite a bit in the grocery store. And it you wind up with a pretty big steak. A lot of times they'll then split those in half and put them in trays so that you don't have quite as big of a steak. One of the things we know consumers are asking us for today are smaller portions. So we do have a lot of consumers, and we do a lot of consumer research through the beef checkoff, and we know that consumers have been asking for smaller portions. So there is a case where you might want a 12-ounce or a 16-ounce, you know, sirloin or ribeye or whatever the cut is, and there's some times where maybe you don't need that much and you want a 6-ounce. And so what I want to show you is a different way to cut the top sirloin to get smaller portions. So you can do that in addition to or instead of the big face cut sirloin. Okay, so I'm going to start by removing all the fat and the gristle or connective tissue that's on top of this muscle. And then I'll flip it over and do the same on the other side. So anytime we put a knife to beef, we increase, you know, our labor. So if I worked in a, you know, vacuum plant or a grocery store and I'm in the back cutting, you know, I have a labor cost associated with meat. So anytime we put a knife to beef, we increase the cost of the cuts that will come from that. But again, the reason why we might do that is to increase the quality of the resulting cuts. We want to remove anything that could be a detractor of quality, and certainly, you know, connective tissue, gristle would be a detractor of quality. But also any heavy pockets of fat would be as well. So the sirloin itself, this top sirloin, is pretty lean. So I'm just taking off the heavy fat and connective tissue that's on the very top. You know, the rest of the sirloin that's left here is pretty lean. Okay, so once I have that sirloin cut and trimmed, set the trimmings aside, and then again, you know, a traditional cut sirloin will just be cutting straight across and getting several really big steaks. So what I'm going to do instead is I'm just going to split this into roughly thirds. So I'm going to split this into three roughly equal portions. And each one of these portions could be a small sirloin roast on its own. So we would call these a petite top sirloin roast or a petite sirloin roast if I left it full on its own. But I also want to show you how to cut steaks from this. So from any of these three portions, I can take these, make sure it's trimmed up really well, and then I can cut steaks end to end from any of these three portions. Typically what we do in beef fabrication is we'll square off any tapered ends, and then I'm going to start cutting steaks. And I'm going to cut these pretty thick. You know, I'm going to cut roughly 1-inch thick steaks from this sirloin so that we still get a pretty good eating experience from these. We know that thickness of steaks does matter to consumers. A thicker steak tells them that it's a higher quality, higher value cut versus a very thin steak. Maybe they're looking for a thin steak. Maybe they need a minute steak or a cube steak. But I'm going to cut these as if we were, you know, at a restaurant, and we want to make sure we have a perception of high value. So we cut these a little bit thicker and cut these into top sirloin fillets would be one name for these. Another name would be center cut top sirloin steaks, because we've, you know, removed all the connective tissue, the cap is off the top, and I've split it in thirds and made these center cut steaks. And then sometimes you'll hear these referred to as baseball cut or baseball steaks as well. I think it's just because of the shape and size now of this sirloin. So instead of having a full face cut sirloin that's kind of long, multiple muscles and some fat connective tissue there, we split this into thirds, and now we have these nice kind of round shape, thick cut top sirloin fillets or center cut sirloins. And you can imagine that if you think about a filet mignon being, you know, round, nice and round and thick cut, you know, you're kind of borrowing from the equity that we have in the filet mignon and applying some of that to a sirloin by cutting it this way. Give you a little bit better value perception, because it looks to a consumer like something they've had before, something they recognize. They generally recognize and like round-shaped steaks. They, in their mind, they kind of know what they would do with that. And I think a lot of times they equate it to like a filet mignon. They know that can go on the grill. They know they can probably manage that. When we have interesting shaped steaks and cuts, they do wonder a little bit more what to do with that. So I can take either one of these remaining pieces and do the same thing with that. So again, we can get quite a few of these steaks. We could vary the thickness depending on what our needs are. We could cut them thinner, we could cut them thicker. But you can get quite a few of these top sirloin fillets from one sirloin. So I'll go ahead and finish this one out, and then I'll show you kind of the full array here, because I'll leave one as a small roast so you can see the versatility that we have with the sirloin. So you can cut any mixture of roasts and steaks. I can cut all of it into steaks, and it really gives the versatility of your kind of merchandising these different cuts. Gives you the option of cross-merchandising roasts and steaks. Doing it all as roasts, doing it all as steaks, and having a little bit more versatility there. And these are the trimmings that you see that are left over for trimming the outside of the sirloin. So not too much that we have to deal with. And then if I did have a grinding program, I would certainly use that. Okay, so that's what I have for you today. We'll transition to the next speaker, but I just wanted to remind you one last time about beefandtwistfordinner.com. Go there and check the website out. If you're interested in the sirloin or any of the cuts we talked about there, you can just type the name of that cut in and you'll find a lot of good information, including cutting videos on these different cuts.